evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington, and here are some of the stories we are covering for you today, Thursday, August 22nd, 2019. South Sudan's former foreign minister calls the newly approved budget that gives China oil in exchange for infrastructure a big mistake.
If you do the math, if you do the calculations, you probably come to the conclusion that you are going to be paying maybe about $1.7 or $1.8 million per kilometer. And now this raises eyebrows.
And returning South Sudanese students from Zimbabwe say they won't get their certificates of graduation until the government pays their school fees.
The only mechanism right now, and I'm very happy that the director is here, is for them to continue to push together with our Minister of Higher Education, Honorable Justin In, so that they can clear these fees.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. South Sudanese lawmakers yesterday passed a 2019-2020 fiscal year budget totaling more than 200 billion South Sudanese pounds, or about $1.6 billion. Some lawmakers raised concerns over what they call undisciplined spending agencies and pointed out that government accounts have not been audited in some 4 years. Dimo Silva Aurelio reports for VOA from Juba.
The 208 billion South Sudanese pound budget is much larger than last year's 126 billion South Sudanese pound budget. It includes a 77 billion South Sudanese pound deficit, which the government claims will be covered by the expected difference between the benchmark and the actual market price of oil sales. David Nailo Mayo, a specialized committee and chairperson of the Finance and Economic Planning, says the government expects to collect 125 billion pounds from net oil revenue and about 29 billion pounds from non-oil revenue to finance this fiscal year budget.
The government expenditure for the FY 2019-2020 is estimated at 208 billion, 155,265,545 South Sudanese pounds, and will be covered through the following sources of revenue: the oil revenues, the levies of taxes, tariffs, and user charges and fees.
The lawmakers allocated a $50,000 medical allowance for themselves in the latest budget, according to Mayo.
The national legislature directs that the process of individual MPs applying for medical entitlements or referrals should cease, and instead, a USD $50,000 package be allocated to each honorable member for medical coverage annually, effective from this FY 2019-2020.
Lawmakers also approved spending 1 billion South Sudanese pounds to buy a presidential jet. Nailo says nearly half of the budget, 96 billion South Sudanese pounds, the equivalent of $600 million, will go to the Chinese Shandong construction firm in the form of crude oil in exchange for building roads and other projects across South Sudan.
The Road Infrastructure Fund was first estimated at 10,000 barrels per day. And if we go by that, you will deduct 32 billion SSP. But if you want to go for 20,000 barrels per day, you will deduct 64 billion from the gross government receipts. And if you go for what we call scenario three, that is, you take 30,000 barrels per day and invest it on roads and other infrastructure, then you will deduct 96 billion from that.
Former South Sudan Foreign Affairs Minister Nyal Deng Nyal, who President Salva Kiir fired earlier this week, says the China-South Sudan transaction was a mistake for South Sudan, even though he played a role in approving that decision.
The problem is that project is expected to cost something in the region of $711 million for a 400-kilometer stretch of roads. If you do the math, if you do the calculations, you probably come to the conclusion that you are going to be paying maybe about $1.7 or $1.8 million per kilometer. And now this raises eyebrows.
South Sudan Minister of Petroleum and Mining, Awo Daniel Chuang, did not comment on the China-South Sudan deal, but says he is confident the country's oil revenue will rise before the end of the year.
Production stands at 173 to 177 because it fluctuates as we face some difficulties in logistics. And therefore, we should be targeting like 190, 195 by the end of the year. So we are gearing up efforts for us to open up some additional wells.
The first budget presentation was rejected by Parliament after lawmakers demanded that Finance Minister Salvatore Garang pay civil servants their salaries in arrears for 6 months. The minister has since paid civil employees 2 out of the 6 months' back pay the government owes them.
We would like to clear the salaries plus the foreign missions, and these 10 months, since then we reduce the patient of salaries to be a thing of the past, and we do this, a normal monthly payment. So I hope we are going to do it, and it is a must. It is the duty of the Minister of Finance to pay the government workforce. May it come what, and the 30th, they must be paid.
The approved budget allocates 194 billion South Sudanese pounds to government spending agencies and 3 billion South Sudanese pounds for emergency contingency funds. $10 billion was approved for the implementation of the peace agreement and another $1 billion for interest payments. 17 billion South Sudanese pounds is to be transferred to state and county governments for their operating budgets. The health sector is allocated 2,342,000,000 South Sudanese pounds, up from 1 billion pounds in last year's fiscal budget. 15 billion South Sudanese pounds is set aside for the security sector. Public administration gets the same amount. The education sector received 7 billion South Sudanese pounds, up from 1.8 billion last year. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
Civil society activists and at least one South Sudanese analyst say regional bloc IGAD has not been pushing the parties hard enough to carry out the terms of the revitalized peace deal. IGAD issued a communique yesterday following recent consultations with the parties in the Ethiopian capital Addis Ababa. A professor of political science at the University of Juba says the outcome of the meeting fell short of citizens' expectations. Waki Simon Wudu has more for VOA from Juba.
The IGAD communique calls for regional heads of state to encourage President Salva Kiir to disburse the balance of $100 million he pledged for the implementation of the peace deal. It also recommends that IGAD heads of state convene a face-to-face meeting of the top leadership of the parties to resolve outstanding issues, including the number of states and remaining security arrangements. The regional body also called on IGAD member heads of state and the South Sudan government to hold a summit in mid-September 2019 to decide on the status of rebel leader Riek Machar. The communique also urges the parties to barrack, train and deploy at least half of the 83,000 unified forces before the end of September. Professor Abraham Kualinyon says the communique should have been stronger in its language on urging the parties to implement the peace deal ahead of the November 12 deadline.
It doesn't really give pressure to the parties to the extent that the parties are seriously coming back to their destination without having a real action point that they are coming to do, because the communique is only trying to exhort them to be able to continue in with their previous status quo.
Kual says South Sudanese expected the consultative meeting in Addis Ababa to resolve the dispute over the number of states and the status of Riek Machar, whose movement remains restricted.
They were expecting that the people will come up with the real program, whether the government will be formed or not. They want also to know that the two parties were supposed to come with the press conference to say that this is what we had consulted and we have come into agreement on this point, so that the people of South Sudan will know that the signatories to the agreement are in consensus.
Kenyi Asin Abdallah, executive director of the Juba-based Advocates for Human Rights Democracy, agrees.
Though we shall come with the result that the number of states is decided by IGAD to be this number or this number. 10 states to the previous one, oh, wow, this is what we're expecting. And also, our expectation is that we need to see that the IGAD will also talk about releasing Dr. Riek Machar from detention, because he's one of the principal signatories to the agreement. Without releasing him would mean the peace is still in doubt on the side of the rebel.
Emilio Lionel Ochoco, who works with the Juba Civic Resource Center, says IGAD is simply massaging rather than requiring the parties to implement the deal on time.
IGAD should not even communicating. They should pressure even these two parties. They should pressure them. We don't want to hear just IGAD have said this, people have said this, and there's no implementation. There should be something implemented. We should not just talk by words and we don't put things in action.
A week ago, a coalition of South Sudanese civil society organizations launched a 90-day countdown to the November deadline for forming the unity government. Coalition member Geoffrey Law Duke says the security provisions, a key component of the deal, have yet to be carried out.
We have not got much time left, and that there are a lot of tasks that needs to be accomplished, and that business should not remain as usual. That we have to see a sense of urgency, and we do not want to see another situation where we give all sorts of excuses for having failed to form the transitional government.
The activists say today are worried that with less than 3 months to go before the end of the pre-transitional period, which was extended by 6 months, the parties will likely not be ready to form a unity government by the November deadline. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
Zimbabwean university officials are withholding the transcripts and certificates of dozens of South Sudanese students at various institutions this year because of unpaid tuition fees. The first batch of returning students arrived in Juba on Monday. Onan Walter Solomon has the details for VOA from Juba.
25-year-old Gloria Loke completed a 4-year course in applied biosciences and biotechnology at the Midlands State University in Zimbabwe. Loke says despite her good performance, the government's delay in paying tuition fees and feeding allowances affected her studies.
There are particular chemicals that you need to work on when you're extracting phytochemicals from plants. It was quite a challenge because it was very hard for me to maybe get some equipment or transportation, because I had to travel from Gweru, city of Zimbabwe, to Chiredzi, which is the southern part of Zimbabwe. And it takes the whole day to get to Chiredzi. But then I didn't have transportation or means to go. I had to go and I asked with my department to provide me with a means of transportation.
Loki says while she is grateful that some university officials helped South Sudanese students complete their studies in Zimbabwe, authorities withheld their certificates and transcripts when it was time to graduate.
I have a recommendation letter from my department, the Applied Bioscience and Biotechnology Department, and I also have a recommendation letter from the Registrar's Office from Zimbabwe and the International Relations Office at Midland State University. I'm hoping this can help me get a job.
25-year-old Moses Katmonchok, a chemical engineering student, is president of the South Sudanese Students Union in Zimbabwe. Kat says the late payments of students' fees also caused Zimbabwean universities to dismiss them, forcing them to seek refuge at their embassy. He says there is a South Sudan government's debt totaling about $1.5 million for the students, which is overdue and must be paid.
The only mechanism right now, and I'm very happy that the director is here, is for them to continue to push together with our Minister of Higher Education, Honorable Justin In, so that they can clear these fees. And also, we request the Ministry of Finance to cooperate such that they can release these funds. We went to the embassy purposely because we wanted to protect the integrity of our country. Look, for instance, if we were to go on the street, it will have sent a very negative image. So we chose to go to the embassy and to stay there until the government would intervene and clear our ears. So that's what we did.
Speaking on behalf of South Sudan's Undersecretary and Director General for Training for Ministry of Higher Education, Job Akwey Alith, the Director General for Admission at the Education Ministry, admits his ministry was unable to buy airline tickets to transport more than 70 students from Zimbabwe back home. Akwey says Dieringoro, the Governor Bang of South Sudan, personally paid for the tickets of 28 South Sudanese students.
It was the minister, the Honorable Governor of the Bank of South Sudan, who facilitated their coming home after they have stayed in the embassy for almost 2 months. And we are thankful to them.
The South Sudanese students in Zimbabwe complained repeatedly about how the government's failure to pay their tuition fees affected their studies. In April, 148 students stormed and occupied the South Sudanese embassy in Harare, demanding that their unpaid tuition fees for 2 years be paid in full immediately. The students have been on scholarship since 2015 in different universities, pursuing both undergraduate and postgraduate degrees. Akui says the second cycle of conflict in 2016 made it difficult for the government to meet its financial obligations of students attending studies abroad. He, however, did not say when the government would pay the unpaid fees. For VOA News, I am Onan Walter Solomon in Juba.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. A Juba City official shuts down a security firm. Find out why when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what puts a smile on your face?
I have a group called Lishi. It's a group full of young children. So when I dance with them, it puts a smile on my face. Makes me happy.
What puts a smile on my face is good food and good people.
Okay, when I see good food and good friends around, well, I smile.
My husband, to me, puts a smile on my face. He cracks jokes. He likes cracking jokes, and that makes me happy.
One thing that puts a smile on my face is to see somebody who's been in trouble or who has had great challenges, and then he has broken through, his life is better, their lives have improved, their marriages, their business. It brings joy to my heart to see people becoming better.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202 630 8011 and we'll get back to you. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202 630 8011. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Juba City Council authorities closed the private security firm Insight Security, formerly called Warrior Security, and ordered its managing director to appear in court this week for allegedly failing to honor contracts the firm signed with its employees. Winnie Serino has this report for VOA from Juba.
Juba City Deputy Mayor Thick Mayadit says he shut down the security firm because its management refused to pay its employees in dollars as it agreed to do in the employee contracts. Employees were supposed to be paid anywhere from $179 to $347 a month depending on their jobs, but were paid in South Sudanese pounds, according to Mayadit.
They go and change them in the black market, then they come and give our people a peanut. Like the one of 179 is 54,000. They come and give a person 15,000 pounds. The one with 292, they come and give these people 20, which is supposed to be 84,000. 347 is supposed to be 108,000. They come and give these people 30,000.
Mayadit says the Juba City Council sent several letters to Insight Security's management ordering them to pay employees in dollars or risk being shut down, but says management failed to comply. He says that's when the Juba City Council decided to arrest the company's managers.
I brought them to court today because they have refused. They don't want to close the company. That is why the police went and arrested them.
Munluak Alor Kwal, the lawyer representing Insight Security, confirmed that Insight Country Manager Paul Glein and Assistant Operations Manager Michael Defoe appeared yesterday in court, where he says the judge dismissed the case.
These staffers of Warrior Security were collected today on the basis that they have obstructed the order and refused to implement the order. But then we have been before the judge. The judge has gone through all the the evidence that was presented, and the judge said there is no proof that there was obstruction. Nobody refused to implement the order, so they have been acquitted. They have been set free.
Taban Anthony, an inside security guard assigned to UAP insurance offices, says it does not matter to him if the company closes, but he wants his pension money.
We have been exploited for the own benefit of the company. Like for some of us who have taken a long time working with the company, so we are targeting our pensions. If our pensions is to be given out, I think we'll try to work out with that pension and try to generate or do any other work with that money.
Paul Gadget, an inside security guard assigned at Mercy Corps, says the government should rather figure out another way to resolve the issue rather than shutting down the company, which he says would hurt many employees.
If they're close, we are going to suffer. That's why it's not... We cannot survive like that because we have a family. We have different issues we are doing. Some of us even, they are studying school. They are paying the money of the school from that one, the school fees. But now, I think it will be difficult for us. And even for this man, we don't know. We are going to get salary or not.
In June, inside security employees walked off the job after accusing the company of failing to pay their wages in U.S. dollars, which they say was spelled out in the employment contracts they signed. Tony Sugden, the chairman of the company, disputes that claim. One inside security employee who did not want to be identified for fear of reprisal from the company told Saturday in Focus his copy of the contract states the payment is to be made in U.S. dollars. When asked to furnish a copy of the contract, he said that page was missing. For VOA News, I am Winnie Serino in Juba.
Finally, this month marks the 400th anniversary of the landing of the first enslaved Africans in Virginia, a state on the eastern coast of the United States. Their arrival was the start of what would become one of the darkest chapters in American history, 224 years of slavery. VOA's Chris Simpkins documented the events where history was made and reported on how these first African slaves, along with the many who followed and their descendants, shaped the course of a nation. He spoke with VOA's Steve Miller.
So, Chris, I really wanted to talk about this project and specifically your experiences with it. You did a number of interviews and you met several people along the way. What really stood out to you and about their stories?
It was an eye-opening experience for me because I'm an African-American growing up in the South in the 1970s. Never read or saw a lot about this history. There was very much little in terms of the history of slavery in our textbooks. And when we did see passages about slavery, it was always from the standpoint that the enslaved people from Africa came to colonial America with little or no skills, and they learned everything once they reached the new world, so to speak. But in my reporting, I found out that that was simply not the case, that the arrival of the first enslaved Africans, they all came here with skills, agricultural skills, political skills. They were baptized. They had their own names, which were eventually taken from them. So that was amazing in and of itself. Also, I didn't know about the arrival of the first enslaved Africans who came to what is now Hampton, Virginia in 1619, the latter part of August, and where their lives began and where they ended up was all new to me and very fascinating in terms of reporting.
Can you share a little bit about that? I mean, as they arrived here, they were enslaved and taken elsewhere. Where do their families, you know, descend from now?
Well, we see a lot in the same, very same area that they arrived in, the Hampton Roads, Virginia area, the Norfolk, Hampton, Virginia Beach areas of Virginia. And what I learned was that these first enslaved people came over. They were not actually slaves at that time because the colony of Virginia had not codified slavery and until 1661.
So what did they come over as then?
They came over basically as what we know as indentured servants. They worked alongside white indentured servants who were under contract, who came primarily from England, and they had no status at that time, Steve. So they were held against their will, but it wasn't until laws that were later passed in Virginia that officially said that they would be slaves. Anyone born to any children born from them would be slaves for life. Basically, the hardship and humiliation of slavery did not end with the 13th Amendment that abolished slavery in 1865, and that African Americans continued to endure racist violence, entrenched poverty, and inequities in areas such as education, employment, and the criminal justice system. And I found out these are legacies today that we in this country have to deal with. That is a direct result of what began 400 years ago.
Chris Simpkins reports for VOA and his video series about the 1619 slave trade can be found on the VOAnews.com website. Chris, thank you so much for your time.
Pleasure to be with you, Steve.
And that was VOA's Chris Simpkins speaking with my colleague Steve Miller. Today, VOA and Norfolk State University are holding an international town hall to commemorate the 400th anniversary of the first Africans landing in North America. The event is being televised live at this hour. You can watch the event at voanews.com and youtube.com/VOA audio. And that's our show for this Thursday. We leave you with the song Al Ajar by Abdelaziz Al Mubarak.
عطرت كل الدنيا وانت مهارة، عطرت كل الدنيا وانت مهارة، وحد حرير خديك وحد مطار، سلمينا لو بالعين او بالاشيار.
Listening to Sudanese musician Abdelaziz Al Mubarak with the song Al Ajar. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. Thanks for listening. And join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from The Voice of America. سلمينا لو